Trish Wagner is the chief privacy officer for Epstein Becker & Green. Epstein Becker & Green is a great, again, partner of the Alliance. They've been very supportive in our in numerous capacities, very involved with the Medicare Advantage Collaborative, very involved with different programming on the legal, on risk, on audit, in a number of ways. And it's a pleasure to introduce Trish Wagner to you. Again, the chief privacy officer. And I'll let Trish tell you more about herself. Trish?
Beautiful. Thank you. And I'm glad to be here. Thank you all for being up early in the morning, especially those from the West Coast, because I know it's really early for you. I've been with Epstein Becker & Green. I've been practicing for over 16 years and actually have been with Epstein Becker & Green for that entire period. And I was lucky or maybe unlucky enough to start practice right as the privacy rule was being rolled out. So when I started at the firm, one of the areas I focused on was privacy, and as you can imagine, that has just exploded. I am also the chief privacy officer for the firm and have been in that role probably for about the last 6 years. And I have to say, it's that role maybe that is, you know, the legal side is very educational, but the practical side of being a privacy officer, particularly for lawyers who all think they know everything, is a little bit challenging as well. And so it's been a nice combination to help me see the practical side of some of the things we're advising clients on. My talk today is going to focus on cybersecurity, and I'm making a pitch here. I know there are no chief information officers here, but I'm making their pitch today. This is really my pitch, because cybersecurity, a lot of times we think, oh, that's the IT department, we'll let them worry about it. They're going to build the systems, they're going to do the protection, we don't have to worry about it. And if there is anything you can get from the talk today, it's really cybersecurity really is important for the organization as a whole. You know, the IT department can only do so much, but they really do need the support of the organization. And that's going to start at the board level. And if it hasn't at your organization, be prepared, because it will. So I know you are not on the, if you're not on the board, you think, what do I care what the board is going to say? Because what happens at the board will translate down through the organization. And we've seen this in lots of compliance, but particularly in cybersecurity. If you try to build up, it's very challenging, because an IT guy will say, hey, we need to block Facebook, right? Okay, we're going to block Facebook. That's how we're going to secure our systems. It gets up to a level where someone in senior management says, well, we can't block Facebook. We have a Facebook page. How are we going to do that? And suddenly the cybersecurity effort stops. So if you start from the top down, you have a board who is saying, wait a minute, cybersecurity is important to us. Enterprise management is important to us, or enterprise risk management is important to us. We're going to evaluate the risks across the organization, figure out our priorities, and then we are going to drive those priorities down through the organization. That is much more effective. The reason that a board cares about this now is they actually have a fiduciary duty to protect the organization. So there's a case quote here. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but there are a couple of things that you want to focus on. The board has to conclude that the corporate information and reporting system, so that's all the auditing and security systems, are adequate, that they exist. And a failure to do so could actually lead to personal responsibility for the board members. So that's why board members care about this stuff. That's why they're starting to care more about this stuff. And cybersecurity is getting rolled into the pile of other compliance and risk management efforts that you need to be aware of. So board members have to comply with what we call the business judgment rule. And what is that? That is that they have a reasonable basis for their decisions. And to have a reasonable basis for your decisions, you actually have to have some information, right? You can't make decisions in a vacuum. So when you think about enterprise risk management, you have to have a way to communicate to the board what risks the organization is facing and how we can mitigate those risks and then prioritize those risks. Because, you know, everything's not at the same level, right? That's your job, figure out what the risks are and what the level is. And then the board will have some comfort that they can make an informed decision on what they should be doing, where they should be allocating resources, because face it, you all have a lot of risk to deal with. You have government audits, you have compliance issues, you have cybersecurity issues. So it's really a way of managing the profile. The other reason boards care about this is it's clear from the government that the government is no longer letting the board just walk away from an organization where there's been an allegation, for example, of fraud and abuse, right? Board members are now being held responsible. And again, remember, if it starts at the board, it comes down. It will come down to every level. The other, just in a cybersecurity world, the two breaches here, these are in private sector, in the public sector. One was the Target breach. Everybody knows the chief information officer and the CEO lost their jobs over the Target breach. But the board of directors is now facing a derivative, shareholder derivative action, meaning that the shareholders are claiming that the board allowed this to occur because they didn't have appropriate oversight over the organization. Okay, this is cybersecurity. It could happen with any sort of risk, any sort of fraud and abuse or government action. There could be an action against the board saying you didn't have appropriate oversight. The same was true for Wyndham. They're also facing the board of directors is also facing a shareholder derivative suit. And the interesting thing, or maybe frightening thing about the Wyndham case is the Wyndham, you know, is a hotel chain. So many of the entities involved in the breach were franchises. So now it's, wait a minute, not only are we worried about our organization, we actually have to push that down to other organizations that are doing business with us. So what's a structure? What's a structure for enterprise risk management, right? Could be a single person who's kind of like the traffic cop, following it all, coming in and figuring out where the risk is. Could be a committee. Some organizations have set up enterprise risk management committees so that they get different points of view. It could be a combination of the both. It could be a chief risk officer who has a committee where they can discuss what risks the organization is facing and what the organization would like to do with it. There is, of course, an intersection between compliance and risk management. We should see it as an intersection. We should see it as an overlap. We shouldn't see it as a turf war, right? We don't want it to be, well, this is compliance. We don't have to talk to risk management. Or vice versa, this is risk management. We don't need to talk to compliance. They really should be working together. And above all, somewhere there should be some way to talk to the board about the process. You know, that is key. There should be some reporting, just like compliance has a reporting to the board, risk management should have a reporting to the board. So that's internally, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of the things you can do internally to set up an enterprise risk management. But let's talk about all the strategic partners, or as I like to call them because it's easier, vendors, all the vendors that you're using. So now you not only have to worry about what's going on in your organization, you have to worry about what your vendors are doing as well, and how do you get your arms around what your vendors are doing. In some cases, you may have hundreds, if not thousands, of vendors that are handling, not just handling health information, but handling other sensitive information. If you pick the right vendor, things will be great, right? You'll have the same goals, you'll have the same compliance objectives. You will have a smooth process. When something goes wrong, you'll work together to solve the process. It can be a really good partnership. If you end up with a partner who is not a true partner, it can be a disaster because their failure can relate to you. You can lose customers, you can lose members, you can lose money, you can lose other vendors. It can really have a significant negative impact on your organization. In the privacy and security world, while I can make lots and lots of legal arguments why the company should not be responsible for the actions of the vendors that they hire, we are seeing that is not always being played out. The government often will hold the company responsible for their vendors. And I actually have an example of that a little later on. And even if we can make the best legal arguments in the world, the public will say, well, wait a minute, you selected that vendor. Now you're saying, oh, not my fault. I don't know what they did. That's their fault. Well, you can't say that, right? The court of public opinion will hold you accountable if no one else. And you can have a great partner. Again, it's not a static relationship. Remember, it's very dynamic. Your partners may change. They may change management. They may change owners. They may be in a financial situation that you wasn't there when you started the relationship. So you really need to be thoughtful about what's going on with your vendors, where they are in the industry, whether there have been changes in their management, because that can change their strategic goals. It can change their financial status. It can have a very big impact, which could affect your organization. So how do you mitigate that risk? So apologies to all the service providers in the room, but here's how you can mitigate the risk. First of all, you do due diligence. The time has passed when you can just sign an agreement and not worry about it. You really need to, particularly for your strategic vendors, those that are going to have a significant impact on your operations or hold significant information of yours, you've got to do some due diligence on those organizations. And when I say due diligence, I mean more than send a survey. You know, right now, big in the cybersecurity world, is to send a survey out to vendors saying, here, fill out this 20-page cybersecurity survey, tell us about your security profile. And that's great. We actually recommend it. That's a perfect thing to do. If, when it comes back, somebody looks at it, right? If somebody fills out that questionnaire and it comes back and gets thrown in a box somewhere or thrown in an inbox or stays in the email, never gets opened, that's not helping you. And the reason it's not helping you, first of all, the whole purpose of the survey is to do a little diligence on your vendor to make sure they know what they're doing. But secondly, if they tell you something in that survey, so let's say, again, in a cybersecurity world, the vendor says, oh, we don't encrypt anything. We allow everyone to use thumb drives. They travel across the country using thumb drives. We've never had a problem. Right? Breach occurs because somebody lost a thumb drive. You go to your vendor and you say, how could they do this? How could this happen? To which their response could be, well, we told you. We put it in the survey you sent. You didn't have a problem with that. You never told us not to do it, so you can't complain now. So if you do a survey on your vendors, you really need to actually look at the survey. We always like people to go on site. Again, particularly for big vendors who have a critical are of critical importance to you. For example, if you're contracting with a call center, you want to go see what they're doing, right? How the people are sitting there. If you can, and you know, call centers get a little weird about this because some good ones are so nervous about privacy, but it's good to listen into a couple of calls. What exactly are they saying to people when people call in? How are they treating people? And it's even better if you can listen into those calls without the person on the phone knowing it, right? The call center person knowing it, so you know how they actually do act when no one's around. I actually heard of one company who had it set up so the compliance officer could periodically dial in and listen to calls. And it was seamless, so no one knew when that was occurring. And she said it was incredibly helpful because it was a really nice way. She didn't do it very often. And of course, appropriate disclosures to the consumers calling in or the members calling in. But she said it was a nice way to get a check on the vendor and make sure that they were actually following the call scripts to the extent there were some. They were treating people appropriately. They weren't creating issues. Right? All of those things that are important. The other thing, we do upfront mitigation in addition to site visits. Think about the contracts. Okay? Everybody hates legal. We know everybody hates legal. Legal, oh no, we gotta send it to legal. It's gonna stop the process. Oh, they're gonna look at the contract. Okay, legal here is gonna be your friend. In risk management, legal is your friend. You know, I was in science before I went to law school. And in looking back, I think I was always born to be a lawyer because I was born being able to imagine the worst possible case that could happen, right? If I'm in a situation, I'm like, oh, man, this it looks okay now, but just one wrong move and it's all just a terrible thing. Well, that's what you want in your lawyer. That's what you want in the contract. You want protections built in. Everybody always says, we've heard it a million times, oh, this is a great relationship, they're a great vendor, nothing is gonna happen. Okay, something's gonna happen, right? If you're lucky, nothing happens. Most of the time, something happens. It's great that you have a great relationship. It's great if you can work it out without going through litigation or going through some arbitration or mediation, but your contract really needs to be strong. In the cybersecurity world, we laugh. It used to be those business associate agreements were a little addendum at the end of the agreement. Everybody signed them, nobody read them, and everybody went off and did their thing. Now they're like the linchpin of the deal, right? You think you have a deal, everything's signed and sealed, you send the business associate agreement to the privacy officer, and suddenly the brakes are on. Because suddenly there are things in that business associate agreement that aren't acceptable. So as part of your risk management, think about those agreements as, again, a partnership. It is a business deal. You need to get the business done. You need to partner with this vendor, but start incorporating the privacy officer, the security officer early on, so that at the end of the transaction, you're not hitting a roadblock. Here's my other pitch for security officers. You know, and I get from experience. If you tell people no, you can't do something, chances are they will say, I'm gonna figure out a way to go around the system, right? So our security officer, our chief IT officer, chief information officer at the firm, has a terrific attitude. He's not a pushover by any means, but if you say to him, gee, we want to do this, he will say, no, I can't let you do that. But here's what I can let you do. And you want to have those discussions early on. You want to try to build that partnership with your security team, because it is true, they will say no a lot. But they actually also know some workarounds. So try to say to them, if they're saying no, say, well, look, here's what we need. You know, we're gonna be able to need to do this quickly. What's the workaround? What's a secure way of making this happen? The other reason your security officer should be your new best friend is when you're evaluating your business partners, you want your security officer evaluating them too. You want his or her way in on, do they know what they're doing, right? You might know whether they know what they're doing in terms of claim processing or call centers or whatever they're doing for you. You want the security officer in to say, yeah, they really know how they're protecting the information as well. Yes?
I just wanted to stress a little bit more what Chris talked about in terms of the contracts part. Chris is really hit a really important something that we need to keep in mind. So when you get the vendors to help you manage your cybersecurity environment, one of the things you want to keep at the back of your mind is, first, how the vendors are going to discover a lot of potentially maybe bad things that you have as a process. You need to figure a way to protect that from outsiders. That's one of the things you also need to have at the back of your mind when you bring a vendor in. For instance, one of the things we've done at Network Health is, instead of, say, we bring Mandiant or we bring in CoFire, one of those top-of-the-line vendors to help us do our vulnerability tests, et cetera, et cetera. Well, what we do in their contracts is we have them, this report is generated, and we're able to protect that information through maybe a confidentiality agreement or through some kind of mechanism that's available such that your private information or the way you operate is not all of a sudden discoverable, easily discoverable. So that's something you need to have at the back of your mind as you bring in those vendors. And Chris couldn't stress it more. You need to read your cyber program. That's a contract you have for with your insurance, the carriers, that's going to pay all, you know, if you are experienced a breach. You need to read that and not just put it on a shelf, because in that contract that you have with the carrier, there are specific requirements that your program must meet in order for them to even pay you any money or help you if you sustain a breach. Now, unfortunately, if you don't read it and you have a breach, you're on your own, because the claim will not be paid or you will not be helped. So what we've done at Network Health is to take our cyber program, in fact, share it with our vendors who are helping us build the program, so they know what we need to be meeting in terms of our security platform so that there are no holes there. So those are some of the things you need to have at the back of your mind as you're going through the contracts, making sure you're dotting the I's and crossing your T's, that those are critical things that can expose the company to really financial downfalls if you don't do those, I call it block and tackling issues. So you couldn't be, you know, that's from the practical side, that's what you need to be doing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That is, I know that contracting is a slow process. I know that everybody gets frustrated with the legal team when they're pushing on one single provision. But, you know, those provisions can sometimes mean the difference between saving the company millions of dollars and exposing the company to millions of dollars. So how do you though, establish the priorities? Because clearly, listening to you all, you have a lot of competing priorities at a health plan, at any health organization right now, right? There are lots of things that you're having to worry about. We borrowed this, we give credit, from the American Institute of CPAs. They actually have top 10 next practices. We made it the top five. We pulled the top five most that we thought were the most important. Number one is actually to establish an enterprise risk management policy, right? It's hard to do enterprise risk management if no one knows it exists and no one knows how to do it. So make sure you have a policy that describes what it is enterprise risk management is doing and who's responsible and how reporting occurs and how to get information to the committee or the enterprise risk management officer. Then you have to be able to understand and assess the risks for the company. Now, companies have lots of risks. Not all of them are equal. Some of them are up here. Some of them are down here. Some of them are up here, but the chances that they will occur are one in a million, right? Some of them are down here, but the chances that they will occur is, you know, one in two. So you need to be able to evaluate those risks and figure out what the company can do to mitigate those risks. And you do that through conversations. Everybody has a different point of view. If you talk to the chief security officer, he'll say, oh, somebody's going to hack into the system. If you talk to chief privacy officer is probably going to say, oh, that somebody's going to inadvertently email a spreadsheet containing patient information to the New York Times, right? Everybody will have a different view of what keeps them up at night. Once you have that, the policy and the management, use that to guide decisions of the organization. So when, make that part of the process, right? When new business opportunities come in, when new business partners come in, part of the evaluation is the risk of that relationship. It's not just, this is a great business deal, this is going to be great for us, we're going forward. Part of it should be, wait a minute, it is a great deal, it's going to be terrific moving forward. Is there a risk associated with that deal? And if there is, how big is that risk? Because that impacts on whether it's such a great deal or not. And make sure you have somebody like me who can see the worst, right? Oh my God, this is going to be horrible. you don't have to listen to them, but at least hear them first. Establish, once you have it in place, establish monitoring. If you've decided on accepting risk and come up with a plan to mitigate risk, make sure it's actually being implemented, right? The worst thing you can do is have a cybersecurity policy that nobody pays attention to, right? We have a policy that you can't use thumb drives in any company computer, but nobody ever did anything to block thumb drives from computers being used, and nobody ever goes around to make sure that thumb drives aren't being used, which you could do by an audit. So if you have a policy and process in place, make sure someone's monitoring it. And you know, again, my theme, report up. Make sure senior management knows, make sure the board knows. There should be a reporting up so that you are not operating in a vacuum. Organization as a whole is making these decisions. All right, let's talk about breaches. This is the fun stuff. It's not really fun because it's when you're in the middle of it, it's not great. But I like to talk about breaches because I think it's a good way for us to learn. I think every breach is unique. We're becoming more and more connected, so everything's electronic now. Even things that we think of as paper really aren't paper. You know, think about faxes. Faxes aren't really paper, they're really electronic. It's all servers now and email. So we think about how electronic the world is becoming. You guys know this privacy and security rule. There are lots of state laws, lots of government programs have security requirements on organizations. Federally, privacy and security rule are really setting the standard. And the importance of this is it's also giving the Department of Health and Human Services Office for Civil Rights the authority to enforce. Government's not immune from breaches. Some of you may have been affected by the OPM breach. I actually was, although I'm not quite sure why, but I got the notice. It affected 21.5 million people. It was access to the OPM computer. I'm sure you saw the head of the Office for Personnel Management being grilled by Congress on what happened, why wasn't the information secured, could this occur, how could this occur? The information was pretty significant, including social security numbers and fingerprints. Because as you probably all know, working for the government, you have to give a lot of information to make sure you, depending on what you're applying for, to make sure you pass clearance. Biggest health plan breach probably to date is the Anthem one. I use this one because Anthem, I think, actually did a nice job. They reported to OCR on February 4th of 2015. They discovered the breach on January 29th. That's pretty fast. It's a 5-day reporting, 6-day reporting. The attack occurred, though, in April of 2014. It was a sophisticated attack, so it was hackers targeting the Anthem system, and it disclosed information relating to 80 million current and former customers and employees that included fully insured, self-insured. It also included anybody who had taken advantage of the Blues pricing, where if you're, so for example, our firm is covered by Empire Blue Cross in New York, but we're in DC, so we get care, we essentially act as though we're in the Care First network. So any of those people who were doing that with Anthem were affected. The reason I have this breach here, the numbers are astounding, but remember under federal law, and federal law is actually pretty expansive, some of the states have much shorter reporting requirements. Federal law gives you 60 days to report to HHS and the individuals. So think about the fact that you discover your server's been breached and you anticipate there are 80 million people who are affected. And you have to figure out who's affected, how to stop it, make sure it's stopped, right? That's probably number one. Who's affected, not just who is affected, but what information was affected. And you got to do that for 80 million people, and you're on a clock. Now, for 80 million people, I would suggest, we suggest this with everyone, do what Anthem did, report early, and when you're doing notifications, do rolling notifications. Don't think you have to wait until you have every single person identified with every single piece of information. Once you have a set of people, start rolling out the notifications. They are pretty standard in the industry right now. I think there are three coming up that do this. It used to be standard to offer 1 year of security theft, identity theft monitoring. It's pretty standard now to offer two. The reason for that is thieves who were stealing information would hold the information for a year, and then they would use it. So now it's up to two. Could be that thieves will hold the information for 2 years before they use it, but then we'll deal with that when it happens. Primera also had a breach. Again, financial and medical records happened actually about the same time as the Anthem breach, both in terms of reporting and in terms of when the breach actually occurred. 11 million people, again, 2 years of credit monitoring or identity theft protection services. Excellus, same thing. You see a theme here, cybersecurity, cyber hackers could affect as many as 7 million people, again, offering cybersecurity complementary identity theft services for 2 years. Now I'm going to switch gears. So those are all hacking. Those are all ones where you can fairly say, maybe. That's our IT department, right? They need to secure our systems. They need to make sure the systems are working as they should. Yeah?
With the recent occurrence of ransomware, has there been any correlation on the backside to, I think there was a case in California with a hospital, how the government has treated those hospitals post the ransomware?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point. I actually think one of those hospitals got fined by the state, if I recall, which shocked me a little bit. But one of the reasons I am using this example of a breach is notice the date they were breached, they reported the breach to OCR was 2012. The resolution agreement, which was a settlement agreement, which OCR came in 2015, 3 years, basically 3 years after the event. So I think it's too soon to know how the government's going to treat ransomware attacks. It might be that they won't do anything. I can guarantee you for every breach over that affects more than 500 people, OCR sends out a letter asking for additional information. And how you respond to that initial request often dictates whether you're going to get even more requests for information.
So I've talked with some people about this particular question, if you don't mind my opining for a moment. So I am an information security officer, and I'm an information security person by training before I became compliance. The interesting thing about ransomware, and we're going to talk about security programs on another day, is that ransomware actually encrypts data in place. So it doesn't exfiltrate data from your organization, and if you can prove that it didn't actually exfiltrate to an outside source, and that the malware that created the encrypted file wasn't communicating back to a malicious party, there's actually not technically a breach. It's a violation of the security rule, not the privacy rule. So you have compromised availability and integrity potentially, but not confidentiality. So remembering that the privacy rule is about the breach of confidentiality, if your security program is designed to really prove that the data didn't leave, which is one of those things that not a lot of security programs are designed to do, it's not technically a breach and it's not breach reportable. That's not to say that they're not going to be interested in the security rule violation, but technically it's not breach reportable if you can prove that.
Yeah, that's actually a great point. And you know, in a different presentation we do, we talk about how important it is when you suspect something. A lot of people want to report right away. That's not always the best strategy. It is really smarter to understand what happened, because in some cases you can prove that it wasn't a breach technically and not have to report. In other cases, it may be a breach, but you may, you know, one of the things we tell clients when they go through a breach is, first of all, it's an ugly process, but everybody's gone through it and you'll survive it. And two, the numbers are gonna change daily, right? You're going to think it affects 100 people. The next day it'll be 250,000. The next day it'll be 200,000. The next day it'll be 150,000. And for the initial period, that's pretty common because it's often hard to figure out what the scope of the breach is initially. But that's an excellent point. If it doesn't leave, it's not a breach.
Just a quick question. When they do the ransomware and they're looking to get a ransom, why don't we have like secure, or maybe we do, I just don't know, like with the federal government have security teams that would actually take it and pay the ransom, follow it, and try to apprehend these people?
They actually do in some cases. The FBI has a cybersecurity squad, and one of the things that is actually, the one thing they do is they have lots of work groups where people can, IT professionals can correspond and understand what threats are there. The FBI also has local offices, and often the local FBI officers will come out and talk about how your what your organization can do to protect itself. But one of the things they will do, sometimes, not always, is try to track down the ransomware. Now, there is a little bit of a turf war. You didn't hear it here. Ah, oh, recorded. It appears there may be a little bit of a turf war between the Secret Service and the FBI, both trying to get in on the cybersecurity investigations. And sometimes we've had situations where we've run into a little bit of trouble with who's going to take control over the investigation. But if you get them and you can get them interested, they will investigate.
Haven't I heard that part of the problem, too, is like extraterritorial foreign hackers or ransomware that we don't have access to some countries, that kind of thing? Isn't that part of the problem, too?
That definitely can be part of the problem. Although I will note DOJ is working really hard at getting partnerships with a lot of different countries for extradition purposes. So hopefully, there will always be countries where that's not going to be feasible, right? But hopefully that's a shorter-lived problem. So just quickly, other than the 3-year investigation before resolution thing to note, because all of those health plans I talked to you before have not yet had a resolution agreement, and it might be none of them will have one, but it is too soon to tell. If they reported the breach in 2015, my guess is there are discussions going on, or will be. Oh, and that just as an aside, if you've had a breach and you got the letter and you responded to OCR and OCR hasn't said anything, you're not quite out of the woods yet, because it can take them a while to get back to you. So, don't start your celebration quite yet. Try to get a letter from them saying, we're closing the investigation, rather than silence. Silence is not always a good thing. Both of these were unencrypted laptops, unencrypted devices. Again, this was back in 2012. There is no question that the Office for Civil Rights and probably the public in general does not understand why information on a mobile device is not encrypted now. It is becoming industry standard. It's becoming not what the government expects. It's becoming what the public expects. And you have to work with, again, back to cybersecurity is part of all of us. It's all part of a team. You can have the best laptop in the world that has encryption on it, but if you never turn that encryption on, it doesn't help. Same thing with a cell phone. Right? Cell phones come with encryption, but if nobody puts a password on their cell phone, you might as well not have encryption on the phone because it's worthless. So it really becomes a team effort of making sure everybody understands the rule, everybody's working toward the same goal. Now, this is probably my favorite one, because I don't know for a fact, but I can imagine how this happened. System was supposed to return medical records to a physician who was retiring. They had 71 boxes, so this is paper, and they took it to his house, but he wasn't home. So they left the 71 boxes, including information from 5,000 to 8,000 people, sitting in his driveway, which he reported. So, I mean, it sounds bad when you read it, but when you think about what probably happened, you think Trish says to Joe, hey, we need to deliver these medical records to Dr. Smith. You got to go take them to his house. Joe says, okay, I take these to his house. He gets there. Dr. Smith's not there. He says, I don't want to make another trip. I'll just leave him here. I'm sure he'll be back soon, and drives off, right? Again, cybersecurity, risk management, it's a corporation process. It has to be communicated. You can't assume people will know what's in the boxes, and secondly, that they, if someone's not there, they shouldn't leave the boxes unattended. So filters down through the organization, even to the people who are doing the deliveries.
So I just wanted to contribute one more item on this. One of the common themes I'm hearing from the presentation, which maybe I want to talk a little bit about, is, you know, how to integrate your cyber program that Trish has been talking about into your ERM program, such that you have a process, you have a way of doing these things in a systematic manner that allows you to really understand what the don'ts are and what the do's are for each process that, you know, you get an exposure of, you have a cyber exposure. You know, I recently wrote two articles about how to integrate your cybersecurity risk management into your ERM program. And I'll share some, you know, just five items of it with you so that it supports some of the, a lot of the things that Trish is talking about. Basically, you need to figure a way to do this integration, which means you need to spend a lot of time with your chief information officer. If you're an enterprise risk person or you're a compliance person, you need to spend a lot of time with them. You need to understand how they operate and be able to understand all the risk that you get from them and integrate that in your risk registers, into your heat maps. That also needs to flow directly to the board. That's one of the things you need to do. The second thing you need to do is you are not an expert. And so the attorneys are not experts either. And myself, we are not experts. What you need is a team. And this team approach involves having people with the right backgrounds, the qualifiers, the mandiants, the vendors that do this for a living. You need to be really working arm in arm with those vendors so that they can show you what's happening, what's the latest thing happening, and for you to integrate that into your cybersecurity program. Three, you need to have an action plan for when a breach occurs, and you need to have that rehearsed fairly well. It's, you know, like everybody's saying, it's not a matter of if, it's when. So you need to have that plan ready, and you need to have that plan being operationalized pretty quickly, what you're going to do, what you're not going to do. So those, you know, three things I think are really critical to understand how to manage your cybersecurity, because these events that Trish has been talking about, there are a ton of them not reported, and there's more going on, and it's going to continue. But the way you effectively manage these things is to elevate that to the board, not only to the board, but you also have to look at your business. You need to look at the various business units and work more cooperatively with them. For instance, I'll give you an example of what we do at that workshop. We've started a process where every Monday we send out a letter. You know, we send out a letter, you know, talking a little bit about the potential cyber threats that you may see this week or next month. Phishing, you know, what it means. Talk about what are the potential things. It stays in front of all them. So this stays in front of the employees on a daily basis so they know what a phishing looks like, why they should not open an email, or why they should not put a thumb drive in their in the work computer. So these are the basic things I just wanted to share with you to support some of Trish's points so that you get more of a feel for what does it mean to really operationalize a cyber program. These are the block and tackles that you need to continue to do. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Very helpful. He's exactly right. I'm going to touch on one last breach, only because it's important, because it actually shocks me. This was a hospital system who reported a breach to OCR, and the breach they reported was not their own breach, it was the breach of their business associate. A business associate had left a laptop in a car that was stolen. The covered entity, of course, has the obligation to report the breach, which they did. The form has actually changed now so that business associate can now actually report on the form that you have to report to OCR, and they can say they're reporting on behalf of a covered entity. But at the time in 2011, that wouldn't have been true. OCR opened its investigation, and again, into the covered entity, right, who had the business associate agreement with the vendor. The covered entity was fined over $1.5 million, basically because they didn't have a business associate agreement in place with that vendor. One, three-page, maybe four, agreement not in place, and it ended up being a fine of $1.5 million. And remember, these are settlement numbers. If you go to the OCR website, which you can, and look through the breaches, two things to remember. First of all, the government is the plaintiff, so they phrase the press release in the way that they view the facts, which may not always be 100% how the other party views the facts. And the numbers reported are settlements, which means the government came in with a higher number. And the government is very expansive in its reading of the penalty provisions of the breach notification, or of the privacy rule, right? They like to ramp it up to the maximum. The other thing to keep in mind is this chart, which I find pretty interesting. 2014, OCR collected about $8 million in fines. 2015, they dropped off a little bit. They got only around $6 million. As of, what's the date, April 25th of this year, they'd already surpassed 2014. They're already above $8 million in fines to organizations. So it's pretty clear they're serious about this. So just to dovetail a little bit on the comments earlier, this really is about enterprise risk management. And again, I'm a cheerleader for the chief information officer here. You've got to integrate cybersecurity into the enterprise risk management for the organization. It's about everyone. The other thing is, you can't assume that everybody understands the language, right? A lot of times you'll be talking to your IT guy and he's speaking a language and everybody's nodding their head and nobody really understands what he's saying. So you need to find somebody in your organization who can translate that, right? If you need someone to translate what phishing is, have them translate what phishing is, so that when IT says, don't open this email, it's a phishing email, people understand that it's not about a phishing trip, that it's actually a bad thing, right? So let's make sure we have people who can translate. Management has a lot to worry about. If they're publicly traded, there may be SEC disclosures, there may be bond covenant disclosures, there may be a lot of issues that need to be addressed. What should we be doing to plan ahead? Again, following the comments, you gotta have a process in place. One of the most effective tools we've seen, other than having an organization experience a breach, is to have desktop exercises where senior management or the key team, or I've seen it done with the key response team and the board, does a desktop exercise of what happens in the event of a breach. Who's involved, who gets called, who gets, what needs to be done, what gets shut down, what continues, where does the notification occur, all of those things. I'm gonna do a shout out to patching. I know that's a technical term, that's the IT department, but again, IT needs the support. Patching should be occurring I forget what the FBI calls it. It's like every Tuesday, Microsoft comes out with the patches needed, and Wednesday, Microsoft comes out with the patches needed for their software, and the FBI calls Thursday Cyber Risk Thursday, because that's the day the hackers see where the patches need to be, and they start focusing on organizations to see if they can take advantage of it before the patch is applied. three different roles. Sometimes they're three different people, sometimes they're one person, sometimes they're two people, actually four different roles. Security officer, privacy officer, compliance officer, enterprise risk manager, right? Those can be four different people. When you're acting, if it's the same person, when you're acting in each of those roles, you have a slightly different responsibility and a slightly different mindset. Again, dovetailing, you have a lot of internal experts, your IT team is terrific, but don't rely solely on internal experts. Even if you have the best IT team in the world, asking them to evaluate themselves is a little bit like asking anybody to evaluate themselves, right? You don't see your own weaknesses. So it doesn't have to be all the time, right? Depending on your security team, doesn't have to be, we always go to an outside expert, but once in a while, same with every other program, once in a while, go to an outside vendor, an outside expert to assess your programs, make sure that what you have is going to be sufficient to protect the company as best it can.
One example in support of what you're saying, I was on a Medicare audit and interviewing a customer service rep and said, where do most of your calls come from? Members, providers? She said, oh no, brokers. I said, really? Most of your inbound calls are from brokers? And she said, yeah, well, we check them on the system. We have a policy and everything, and they are the AOR. I said, really? They're the appointment of representative? She said, no, agent of record.
All right, let's talk about insurance policies a little bit. Everybody always wants to know about insurance policies. They say, oh, we don't have to worry about it. We have an insurance policy. Breach, smeech, insurance will take care of it. You do have to read the policy. You have to know what's covered, what's not covered. It may or may not be covered depending on not only what happened, but when you reported it, how you reported it, how quickly you reported it, who you hired to mitigate the risk. All of that may make a difference on coverage. Cybersecurity can include a lot of different things. Usually it includes notification to the individuals affected. It usually includes forensic, and it may include public relations. It might include legal. But you need to read the policy to make sure you understand what's included. Before you purchase the cybersecurity, or if you already have a cybersecurity policy at the time of renewal, talk to the carrier, because you might actually want to be negotiating some of the provisions. You might already have a vendor who does mailings for your plan. And if you can use that vendor for notification of individuals in the event of a breach, you'll get a better deal than if you use a vendor that's on the panel of the insurance carrier. You might have a preferred law firm. You might have a preferred press relations firm. See if you can get those into your policy so that in the event of a breach, you're not having to switch vendors, switch trusted partners all of a sudden and go with people you don't know. You might not worry about that, but it can be a factor. One thing we have noticed in breaches with insurance coverage, the carriers are not always as responsive as the customer would be expecting, right? So if you have a breach, you want to go. You have your plan, you have your team, you have everybody, you have it set on what's going to happen. You have a breach, you notify your broker who notifies the carrier, and you're ready to roll letters out, and you're waiting on your carrier to approve a vendor. Okay, you don't want to be in that situation. You actually want to make sure the process is going to be quick and fast, and you're never waiting on the carrier. Days, I was involved in one where the government had asked us for some additional information, and we were responding to that, and the carrier said, we'd like to see the letter before you send it to the government. So okay. So we sent the letter before we sent it to the government. It was due to the government. We sent it to the government. A week later, the carrier said, yeah, this will be fine to send to the government. Okay, good, because it's gone. But you need to, and part of that too is communicate with the carrier, right? If there's a deadline pending, you need the carrier to understand that. One of the other things that insurance carriers can do, and actually I would lean on brokers more for this. Brokers are invaluable in this. They have enough experience now that they can tell you not only what coverage would be adequate for you, but more importantly, if you have a good broker, you can go to that broker with your vendor arrangement and say, I have an arrangement with this vendor. This is what they're doing. This is how much information they're handling. How much insurance should I be expecting them to have? And they can give you a pretty good estimate of what a nice insurance policy would be for your vendor. And you know, we've seen our clients do that multiple times. It actually, everybody's happy because the vendor then isn't tied down in indemnification clauses and caps and all sorts of things. They can draft in an insurance provision which will cover the event, and it makes the process go much, much more smoothly. Okay, with that, and 8 minutes left, any other questions? Yes.
Yeah, we're experiencing an issue. I wonder if anybody else has dealt with this. Some of our providers are contracting with vendors to do their billing, and a part of that is that when we may deny something, we'll get a phone call, and it seems to us that it's coming from a non-English first language group. We're convinced it may be offshore. We've done some inquiries. Initially, they said, "Yeah, we do contract with offshore," but then they've turned around and said, "No, we're contracted with a company out of Pennsylvania, and they assure us everybody's within the United States." And so I guess it's a dual question. What issues are, is there any illegality when a provider is contracting with a vendor that may be out of the United States? Clearly, it's hard to, if the primary entity of the company that they're contracting with is United States based, we do have some leverage against them. But I mean, that's the one issue. The other issue is it best practices really, when your information may be going offshores? We do have BAs in place and all that as well, so it's not, that's not the issue. So.
Yeah, so that's a great question, and part of the problem is the cost savings for organizations. I've been involved with organizations who traditionally have refused to do offshoring, but then they started looking at the numbers, and it's really hard to argue it's for some of the savings that can occur depending on your business for offshoring. So there are some limitations on offshoring. Some states actually prohibit offshoring for Medicaid information. Some states prohibit offshoring for other types of information like workers' comp information. And some of those states, you won't find that in a statute or a regulation. It'll be a little fuzzy, but if you call, the regulator will say, "Oh, no, it's our policy to prohibit that." So it may not always be clear. There are some parts of Medicare where offshoring is, and Medicare Advantage, where offshoring is prohibited. It's more related, on the provider side, it's more related to who is getting access to the Medicare system, different from Medicare Advantage plans. So it's a network. Now, if a provider, for example, is going with an organization where you suspect they're offshoring, if it's a healthcare provider, hopefully then it's on them, right? And it's their problem. And hopefully what they've done is contracted with a company that has a base in US, in the United States, so that they actually have some jurisdictional pull. Hopefully also what they've done, some of the organizations we represent that have offshore operations have are upfront about it, right? Yes, we do have offshore operations. Here's what we've done to ensure the security at those operations. We've had it done by U.S. companies, so we paid somebody from the U.S. to go over, evaluate the system in, name the country, and come back and give us the assessment of that. And the reason that's sometimes important is, depending on the country, there can be a lot of dealing, right? There can be a lot of internal dealing of, yeah, you give me my certificate, I'll pay you X amount of dollars. So having the outside source come in and review it. So the most reputable companies do that. So, you know, I can't say offshoring automatically, oh, that's going to be the worst thing in the world. But you do, you're right, you need some protections. You need to make sure they know what they're doing. You have protections that in place, and that you have the jurisdictional pull through your contracts and through their location.
Just to support Trish's point, one other item you can ask for is a SOC 2 report. You know, you can ask those providers that, you know, because for instance, we're a provider-owned organization. So what we do is, you know, if our providers are using third parties and they are offshore, we say, great. You know, what we want from you is for you to send us a SOC 2 report on all the vendors that you're using outside, you know, outside the country. So they send us a SOC report. In the SOC report, you will learn what exactly the type of expectations they have for all the vendors, the offshore vendors. And so when you look at the expectations and you see it meets your expectation, then you say, oh, great, that's the way we'll continue to do business. But if it doesn't meet your expectation, then you go back to your provider and say, hey, you know, can we change this? Because this is what our expectation is. So a SOC report is a really efficient tool to pretty much manage those third-party relationships.
Sorry, and I'm just thinking about my Medicaid. Sometimes Medicaid prohibits offshoring. That too often doesn't appear in statutes or regs. That often is in the contract. So you need to have a contract process in place that everybody can flag those requirements.
Any other questions or reactions to Trish's presentation? Great presentation, Trish. Thank you.
Yeah, save your reactions.
Any questions, reactions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.